Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus 580, we'll talk a little bit about the immigrant experience in America today and perhaps draw some comparisons between newcomers today to the United States and people who came, let us say, 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And for a long time here in this country, we have believed that when people came to live in the United States, fairly quickly they settled in, and it wasn't too long before they began to look like and live like their neighbors. And the question we want to take up today is, well, is this kind of melting pot notion we like to hold on to about America still true? Has it changed? And we'll be talking this morning with someone who has spent some time looking at data on this and, in fact, has been responsible for a major new study that has recently come out looking at the issue of immigrant assimilation in the United States. His name is Jacob Vigdor. He is Associate Professor of Public Policy Studies and Economics at Duke University. And he says that perhaps if you ask that question about the melting pot, is America still like that? He says, well, the answer is maybe yes and no. Perhaps it depends on who it is that you're talking about. We'll talk more about this in this hour of Focus 580. And, of course, we offer people who are listening the opportunity to call in and make comments, ask questions. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people keep their questions and comments brief so we can accommodate as many different callers as possible. Certainly, though, your contributions to the conversation are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can join us. In addition to his teaching and research at Duke, he is a faculty research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He's interested in a number of things, including immigration, also things like housing affordability and civic participation and voting patterns and racial inequality in the labor market, a lot of other things. His articles have been published in many places, the Journal of Political Economy, the Review of Economics and Statistics, the Journal of Public Economics. He's joining us this morning from Duke. Professor Vigdor, hello.
Hello, David. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. And also, maybe I should mention, too, that if people are interested in looking at the study that you authored, probably the easiest thing to do would be to go to the website of the Manhattan Institute, and they can see it there. Just as a way of starting, I suppose, it would be worth noting, as you do early on here, just how much immigration to the United States has increased in the sense of the numbers of people that we're talking about. It's been very significant, say, over the last 30 years, quite significant. Can you talk just a little bit about the numbers of people that we're talking about?
Certainly. If you look at over the period since 1970, that's been a period of very rapid immigration in the United States. Currently, there are somewhere on the order of 40 million foreign-born residents of the United States, and the population of foreign-born people in the United States has doubled since 1990. So that's doubling over a period of only about 15 to 18 years, which is actually a more rapid increase than what we saw in the earlier waves of immigration that took place in the early part of the 20th century or even the mid-19th century.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose then we should not be surprised that the issue of immigration is an issue because of, in part, I suppose, because of the numbers that people were talking about, and also, I suppose, because one particular category of people, that is, if you look at their country of origin, and that is people who come to the United States from Mexico, the number there are virtually larger than everybody put together who came in the past.
That's right. That's right. The number of Mexican immigrants in the United States, it's hard to know exactly because there are many of them who are illegal, of course. But the best estimates suggest that somewhere around a third of the immigrants we have today come from that one country. And that's something mm-hmm. unprecedented. We didn't see that kind of concentration of immigrants from one country in these earlier waves of immigration to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Although I'm sure that it's also true if you look at the history of immigration that the kinds of debates that we're having now are not new, and that people raised some of the same kind of issues in past in reference to people coming from other places. So in a sense, we're replaying the pitch may be a little bit more intense, but we're replaying the same kind of debate.
It's true. There are very strong similarities. You can look at some of the commentary that came out around 1910 or even some of the commentary that came out in the 1850s during these earlier waves of immigration, and they sound eerily similar to some of the debates that we hear going on in the public sphere these days.
Well, let's talk a little bit about assimilation. I suppose that different people will attach different meaning to that term. And I'm interested in, as a social scientist perhaps, or at least for the purposes of our conversation and this study that you were involved in what way do you define assimilation?
I think that for the average person, probably the first thing that pops into mind when they think about assimilation is language. Do immigrants learn English? How rapidly do they begin using English as their primary language? And that's one component of what we look at in this report. So we have assimilation defined in several ways, and language factors into something that we call cultural assimilation, which is the extent to which immigrants adopt the customs and practices of those who are born in the United States. But that's not all we look at. We also look at factors including economic assimilation, which just measures how well immigrants are doing in the labor market, whether they've bought a house, factors like that. Then we also look at civic assimilation, which is a question of whether immigrants are showing signs that they are committed to this country, that they plan on being here for the rest of their lives, that they plan to have their children grow up as Americans. And that's something that we can measure by looking at things like naturalization rates or military service.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps it would be another kind of conversation, but I think that some people, when they hear that term assimilation, that to them means that people give up their connections to the place and to the culture that they came from. That somehow in becoming American, that means that they will be less of whatever it is that they were before. And I'm not sure that that's really what assimilation should mean, although in some people's minds I suppose it does. Is that something that has changed over time, that is people's expectation that in coming to the United States, even if you say you make the commitment to stay in the United States and have your children born here and raised and grown up as American and become an American citizen and so forth, I wonder how over time people have thought about their connections to the place that they came from?
That's a good question. You know, many generations down the road, we see a lot of the descendants of these earlier waves of immigration maintaining some of their ethnic heritage. I don't think it is the case that in the past, immigrants have completely forgotten about where they came from and just gone into the notion of being America and being in America and being American without any regard to the past. There is some tendency to retain some of that heritage even as you and your children particularly adopt some of these customs and practices more associated with the population here. And these days, I think that what we see in many situations is that we have examples of immigrant groups who make much progress. They become citizens at a relatively high rate. Economically, they make a lot of progress. But along those cultural dimensions, they hold back a little bit. They do retain a little bit of their native culture. But to the extent that they're making progress along these other lines, we might not consider that to be such a problem. If you are committed to this country, if you see this place as your home, but you want to retain some vestiges of the culture that you came from, there are plenty of historical examples of that. And I'm not sure that we want to have the cultural aspect of assimilation be the be-all, end-all.
Our guest, just very quickly, let me reintroduce our guest, Jacob Vigdor. He is Associate Professor of Public Policy Studies and Economics at Duke University. He's also Faculty Research Fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research. And we're talking about immigrant assimilation in the United States. He was just involved in authoring a major study that looked at this. It was just published, came out in May. And again, if you're interested in taking a look at this in some detail, just go to the website of the Manhattan Institute and you can take a look at it. And of course, questions, as I said, questions here are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Just generally speaking, now I think that perhaps you need to take this apart and look in greater detail at particular groups of people when you ask this question, well, how are people doing and how do they compare with newcomers of past centuries? But having said that, are there some important and interesting differences, say, that emerge if you look at, say, someone, people who came to the United States, say, early in the 20th century, in the 1900s, and then you jump ahead to maybe the period just after World War II, and then you look at today. If you look at people sort of as those at those three points, or if you, there's a better point to pick, you can do that. I'm just interested in how it is that maybe the experience is different or how it's not different.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the report, we go into some specific examples looking at three groups in particular that we can trace relatively well using census data, both historically and the present. One of those groups consists of Italian immigrants who arrived in the United States in large numbers between, say, 1890 and 1915 or so. And we compare those immigrants to immigrants from Mexico in the modern era and to immigrants from Vietnam in the modern era. And those three case studies, those three examples, really pick up a lot of similarities and a lot of contrasts. So the Italian immigrants, if you look back around 1910, that was a group, when they arrived in the country, they looked very distinct from native-born Americans. Their education levels were very low. They took some of the jobs at the bottom of the economic ladder. They were working in at menial tasks in the service sector or some of the least desirable jobs in the manufacturing sector. But over time, they made progress. They came, they didn't speak English very well when they arrived, but you can see as we trace what happens to Italian immigrants over time, significant signs of progress, particularly when you look across generations. When you look at the children of these immigrants, they end up looking very similar to native-born children very quickly, even if they were actually born abroad and came to the United States as young children. If you look at the more recent groups, Mexicans and Vietnamese, those two cases, they're both relatively large immigrant groups in the United States, but they're different in important dimensions. Mexican immigrants, to a large extent, come to the United States largely as economic migrants. They're coming here to take advantage of opportunities for economic advancement that are not present in their home country. Whereas a large number of Vietnamese immigrants in the United States came here as political refugees. They weren't coming necessarily for the economic opportunities. It was because they had to flee, and they didn't really have the prospect of going back. When you look at the status of Mexicans and Vietnamese when they first arrived in the United States, be that in the late 1970s or the late 1980s or the late 1990s, there's a lot of similarity to what the Italians went through 100 years ago. When they first arrived, they are very distinct from the native population. They don't speak English very well. They start off in economically sort of marginal, lower steps on the ladder. That's the kind of jobs that they get. But there's a very telling difference in what happens to those two groups over time. As Vietnamese immigrants spend more time in the country, like the Italians before them, they make rapid progress. They become citizens at a very high rate. They advance economically. Their children look pretty much indistinguishable from native-born children. Not only do they make progress like the Italians, their progress is actually more rapid. So you could say that the American melting pot, to the extent it worked before 100 years ago, it's actually working just as well, if not better now, at least for some groups. The experience of Mexican immigrants has been really a striking contrast. Over time, as they spend more time in the United States, they don't become naturalized citizens at very high rates. They don't make a whole lot of economic progress. Their children, while it is true that their children look much closer to native-born children than the parents do, it's also the case that we see a few more problems in the population of the children of Mexican immigrants than we do in the children of immigrants from other categories. So if you look over the broad span of history, you can see that the ability of American society to bring in new immigrants and accept them as members of society is strong. The ability of our society to do that is strong, but not every group is taking advantage of that ability. And the immigrants from Mexico and nearby countries in Latin America are really strong examples of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that certainly invites the question, why? What in what are the important things that you can point to that would account for the differences between the experiences, say, of people who come to the United States from Vietnam and people who come to the United States from Mexico?
Well, the refugee versus economic immigrant is an important part of it. There are other types of immigrants who come to the United States primarily for economic opportunities as well, say Canadian immigrants. Now, there's a difference between Canadians and Mexicans in that most of the Canadians speak English. But like the Mexicans, they're not coming here because they're trying to flee their home country. They're coming here for economic opportunity. And like the Mexican immigrants, Canadians, and this the same thing goes for immigrants from many developed countries in Europe. We could be talking about Australia or New Zealand. They do not show very much progress in terms of the civic dimension over time. So they don't become naturalized citizens at very high rates. So the fact that you're coming for economic opportunity and not because you're fleeing a hostile political regime, that explains part of it. Another big part of this which is really important is legal status. The dimensions along which the Mexicans are showing the fewest signs of assimilating would be the economic and civic dimensions. Along those two dimensions, they really stand out from other immigrant groups in the United States. And there's one really big barrier to economic progress and to civic progress for Mexican immigrants, and that is a large proportion of them can't become citizens. And a large proportion of them can't enjoy very much economic progress for the simple fact that they cannot work legally in the United States. So when I look at the Mexicans versus the Vietnamese, the reasons for their coming play into this, but the fact that we have a very large population of undocumented immigrants who don't have the legal right to become citizens, who don't have the legal right to work, that is a strong barrier to their assimilation. And what's interesting about this is that a lot of people get upset about Mexican immigrants because they speak Spanish. When you look across the history of immigration, immigrant groups, especially adults who come to the United States as adults, their rates of learning English have always been low. So in that respect, Mexican immigrants and immigrants from Latin America don't really stand out. That's not really what distinguishes them. What makes them look different from other types of immigrants is not the fact that they speak a different language. That we've seen before. Their low rates of economic and civic progress are what make them stand out. And that doesn't really relate to their language so much as it does to their legal status.
Mm. I think that's interesting that we make such a thing of the language issue. And as you say, particularly when it comes to people who come from Mexico, where when their pattern seems to be like people who have come in the past, that is the sense that, you know, people come from another country speaking another language, the first generation, maybe they managed to learn enough English to get along, but they still hang on to their original language, and maybe they feel more comfortable speaking that than their children. Maybe are functionally bilingual, perhaps leaning towards English. And then by the time you get to the third generation, by the time you get to the grandkids, those kids, they can't speak the language of the grandparents at all. So it doesn't take very long for that to happen. And that we've seen that pattern before. And yet it seems that we get very exercised over the fact that that pattern just has to work itself out. And in this particular case, there seems to be an awful lot of sort of heated debate around that particular issue, the language issue.
I think people tend to focus on language because language is obvious. When you see someone on the street or you see someone at work and they speak a different language, that's a very clear indicator of assimilation. It's not necessarily the best indicator, but it's one that's obvious. You can tell by listening to someone if they're not speaking English. You can't necessarily tell by listening to someone whether they've become a citizen or what kind of job they have, or how well educated they are. And I think that these are the more important indicators that we want to look at over time. Are people making economic progress? Are they making progress civically? Are they becoming citizens? People focus on language because language is the easy thing to observe. To actually figure out whether someone is a citizen, to figure out what kind of job they have, you'd have to get into a prolonged discussion with them. It's not something you can instantly observe just by listening to someone.
I think, too, it's interesting that the comparison that you draw around this issue of civic assimilation, the comparison between people who come to the United States from Mexico and people who come from Canada. Now, admittedly, there is a big difference there, the big issue perhaps being fluency in English. But at the same time, it seems that we don't, for Canadians who come as economic migrants, that is, they come here to work and perhaps don't have that commitment to become American citizens and still, in a sense, really want to hang on to their identity as Canadians, somehow that doesn't seem to bother us quite as much.
Yeah, I think that's true. That sort of points out something that we're going to have to think about very carefully as we take up the issue of immigration policy. If we focus too much on language, That's sort of saying that we would like to take Mexican immigrants and make them look more like Canadians. We'd like them to become fluent in English, and we don't really care if they display any sort of long-term commitment to the United States or whether they're here just for economic opportunities and they intend to go back in a few years. Now, maybe that's what we want to do as a society. Maybe that's the kind of policy that we want to advocate. But I think that if we were to advocate that, we would be missing something that has sort of traditionally been a part of our immigration policy, and that is we want immigrants to come here who want to become Americans. And if that's a higher priority for us, then we need to step back a little bit. Because if you look at the experience of, say, a group like the Vietnamese, and the naturalization rate amongst Vietnamese immigrants is higher than it is for any other immigrant group, at least any other major immigrant group in the United States. But they don't necessarily learn English all that quickly if they come as adults. So we could encourage people to become more like the Canadians, speak English, and we don't care if you stay here, and we don't care if you're committed. Or we could emphasize the commitment, the desire to become American, and not sweat the language too much. Because as you mentioned just a few minutes ago, it's very common for immigrants who come as adults to have difficulties learning English. It's hard to learn a new language when you are an adult. It's just cognitively difficult. There's a part of your brain that sort of doesn't work quite as well when you're older. The kids do a much better job. Kids are much more adept at learning languages. And you see this if you look in elementary schools, you will see that you have lots of kids whose parents don't speak any English, and yet the children are completely fluent.
We have a couple of callers here, and we'd like to invite others into the conversation. And the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. The toll-free line, if it would be a long-distance call for you, is 800-222-9455. And maybe just as we're almost at our midpoint, I should very quickly introduce once again our guest, Jacob Vigdor. He is Associate Professor of Public Policy Studies and Economics at Duke University. He's also a Faculty Research Fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research and author of a recent report looking at immigrant assimilation in the United States. And again, if you'd like to look at that, go to the website of the Manhattan Institute. That's www.manhattaninstitute.org. And we have a couple of callers here, and we'll start with someone in Atlanta, Illinois, and this is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
Very interesting discussion, and a really, really complex discussion I'm having a hard time getting a handle, not on your discussion, but on immigration in general. And the one thing that you covered a little bit earlier that was where my interest lies mainly is the cultural side of things. The United States, over the years, has been a leader in some culture institutions like national park systems and national refuge systems and laws like the migratory bird laws that protect our songbirds, and a lot of the immigrants' home countries don't, at least in the past, haven't had the interest in those kind of areas. So all those areas are under a little bit of pressure, and I think in the long term they might be under greater pressure as our culture does change, and or it might be economic, or it might be just overpopulation that's putting pressure on these areas to not be the areas or laws that they once were. And so you kind of touched on that, but to getting more specific to those kind of institutions, what do you think the long-term effect of immigrations will have on those institutions?
So those institutions being primarily parks and wildlife refuges and those sorts of natural resources.
That's exactly right.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that if you take a global view of this, the long-term impact – in the United States, I think that there's not too much of an immediate threat from immigration on things like national parks and national wildlife refuges, because I think the primary impact of immigration is to bring immigrants to urban areas, and urban areas are very often at some remove from some of our sort of national treasures out there. To the extent that there are – pressures out there or threats, I think that those could probably be managed through attention to federal policy. Now, it could be that we need a little bit more federal funding to help shore up some of these parks and refuges. But I think that that's sort of an issue that's a little bit separate from immigration. You can think of immigration more broadly as something that globally could have a positive impact on this, because if you look at some of the countries where we draw immigrants from, they are countries that don't have quite the same record of environmental protection. Of course, you know, we have a fair number of immigrants, more than a million immigrants in the United States from China, and China has a very poor economic. They have a very poor environmental record. So one of the things that's easing those pressures in these other countries, so countries like China or Mexico, some of the pressures to degrade the environment in those countries are actually relieved by the fact that people can come to the places like the United States for economic opportunity. So rather than build a new factory in China, which will pollute the atmosphere and have a very negative impact perhaps on the global environment, we can relieve some of that pressure by providing opportunities for immigrants here where there actually are stronger environmental policies on the books. Now, you know, how well they're enforced is another question. But to the extent that we are relieving some of that pressure globally, I think that the impact could actually be positive.
But on the other hand, with immigration, will definitely increase our population, which is moving us more towards some of those other countries, because that's probably China and Mexico, that's probably one of the reasons that environmentally they were degraded because of population. So, again, and I'm going to hang up here, enough's enough, but it's a really, really complex issue, and I congratulate you for making an attempt to put some sense to the whole thing. So thanks.
All right. Thank you very much.
Let's go to another caller here. This is someone on our line number one. Hello?
Urbana?
Oh, yes. Go ahead, please. Yes.
Yeah. I'm a naturalized citizen myself. You spoke about language as an issue, and it certainly is. But there is another aspect to that, and that is race. In spite of growing up here, the children of immigrants, oftentimes, despite their abilities to speak fluent English without accent, are still looked at as coming from somewhere else. One experience in the family tells me, for example, that when children applied for graduate school, without looking at their forms, they're sent international applications simply because their names are different. Or after being naturalized for half of the time that I've been here, 30 years, I'm still asked the question, where are you from? And it's a legitimate question in the sense that if I take it in that spirit, they're asking what country I came from originally. But more often than that, it's implied that I am not an American. And there needs to be some amount of adjustment that the general population undergoes. It's happening, surely. As time goes and more people of different color are coming in, that there is more sensitization to that fact. But race and religion certainly differentiate between people who came to this country, say, before World War II, and those who are coming in now. It probably was easier for those who came from European backgrounds who were already, first of all, racially very similar, and secondly, had the same religion. It's a lot easier to assimilate and be accepted than people who speak different languages, have different race and different religion. So I'm wondering if language is being overemphasized and other factors not sufficiently recognized. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, I appreciate the comment. What do you think?
It's an interesting comment. It's absolutely true that one of the things that distinguishes the immigration wave that we've had since about 1970 is that the rise of immigrants from Latin America and Asia who by and large have a degree of racial distinction from the sort of native-born majority. One thing that's easy to forget, though, is that in these earlier waves of immigration that happened in the early part of the 20th century or even the mid-19th century, there was a similar form of xenophobia which resulted in discrimination and many ways of sort of ostracizing the immigrant population of those days. 100 years ago, an Italian immigrant was seen as basically a different race of person by the American-born majority. There were lots of – you go back to the late 19th century and you can read lots of books that will tell you about the discrimination that Irish immigrants faced, that there were lots of workplaces that put a help wanted sign out, but then they would put under that sign, no Irish need apply. So the notion of discriminating against immigrants because they're different, because they look different, because they sound different, that's something that sort of it's an element that's intertwined in the history of immigration in the United States. On a personal level, my last name is Vigdor, which is not exactly your all-American last name. And I am asked quite frequently, what kind of a name is Vigdor? And so to that extent, you can still – I'm sort of a third-generation immigrant myself. My grandfather came over from Russia back in 1904. But even now, more than 100 years after that, I still am sometimes spoken to with this sense that, well, this is not sort of normal. That's not an American name. Where does that come from? I think that's something that's sort of in the nature of inquisitive people. When they see – of course, they don't ask me what my name is when they just look at me because I sort of look kind of like an ordinary American person. But it's people who look distinct and people who have distinctive names – yes, I think it is probably the case that they are going to arouse some intrigue in people who for whom this is something new, and that's part of the process, I think. But to what extent does that process actually harm society? To what extent is that process actually personally harmful? I think that we've managed to get through those earlier episodes. You know, the discrimination has happened in the past. I'm sure that there is discrimination occurring today with some of the immigrants from Latin America and Asia. But I don't see anything in the current wave of immigration to suggest that something has changed in American society over the past 100 years. If anything, I'd be inclined to say that the American population is actually more tolerant now than it was 100 years ago. And the life of an immigrant today, even if that immigrant is racially distinct from the native majority, and even if they're linguistically distinct from the native majority, I suspect that life is actually not so bad compared to the life of an immigrant 100 years ago.
All right. Let's talk with someone else. Another Urbana caller. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Maybe I missed something in what you're saying here. One of the things that concerns me is that when you're talking about the economic immigrants, people who come for economic reasons, you're sort of comparing Canada and Mexico as if what they're coming from is very much similar. I would say that the life of a typical Canadian person coming to the U.S. to work is substantially different and probably substantially better than the life of most of the Mexican immigrants who are coming. Mexico has a caste system that's still in operation, whether we want to admit it or not. And people who are coming and who are coming illegally tend to be folks who are economically at the lower end of things and don't have a lot of resources and a lot of opportunities. And that's the reality. Another thing that concerns me is that you're talking as if the lack of civic participation is somehow their fault, as if they were actually going to be welcomed into the civic discourse and civic participation and all that if only they were legal. And I kind of doubt that. I kind of feel like you're blaming the victim, and I'd like to hear a little more about that to maybe make it a little more in line with what I think is really going on, and I'll hang up and listen on the radio.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, there's a two-part question there. So the comparison that I made between Canadian and Mexican immigrants is certainly not to suggest that the two are indistinguishable from each other. As the caller pointed out, that it's nothing could be further from the truth. It is true that a large number of Canadian immigrants are actually drawn from the highest echelon of Canadian society. Those are people coming to the United States to work because there are specific opportunities in the United States that are not present in Canada. Canada is a developed country. The people who come here, they're very often professionals. They are very often landing at the top rungs of the economic ladder, whereas immigrants from Mexico are very distinct from that. Immigrants from Mexico are frequently drawn to take, you know, the old line that you hear in the political speeches quite a bit is that they're taking the jobs that Americans don't want. To what extent that is really true, I don't want to really get into it right now. But they are unskilled workers. They are coming to the United States because opportunities for unskilled workers in the United States are much better than the opportunities for such workers in Mexico. At least they pay much better. The comparison that I made between Canada and Mexico was to draw out this similarity that they have, that they are both coming for economic opportunity. It is absolutely true that they are coming for opportunities that are at the opposite ends of the economic spectrum. But they are united in the fact that they are both coming for economic opportunity rather than coming because they are fleeing a political situation that is unsustainable for them. And that's what creates the similarity that we see in some of their assimilation patterns, that they don't become citizens at very high rates, for example. And that sort of leads me into the question number two from the caller, which was, are we blaming the victim here? If we look at the low rates of civic assimilation amongst Mexicans, does that say something about the immigrants, or does that say something about us? And I think that the fairest answer to say is that probably it reflects a little bit of both. What if you go and read this report, what it really says is that we don't know. This report doesn't tell us for sure what's going on. Mexican immigrants, to a large extent, are blocked in their efforts to engage in civic assimilation because they are not legal. They don't have the right to do that. And if we wanted – so people have asked me before, what's the one thing that we would do if we wanted to increase the assimilation of immigrants in the United States? And I give people an answer that a lot of times they don't want to hear, but the answer is that we need to change our laws, that if you really wanted to increase assimilation, you would have something that looked like an amnesty program, because I think the number one barrier – to civic assimilation amongst immigrants from Latin America who are illegal is their legal status. It's not that they can't speak English or anything like that. It's their legal status. And what can we do to change their legal status? Well, we can change the law. It is true, however, that while it is true that that laws form a relatively important barrier to assimilation for Mexican immigrants, the fact remains that they are economic migrants. They are coming for economic opportunity. And so even if we had some sort of blanket amnesty, and I don't want to go on record as saying I'm in favor of a blanket amnesty program, but that's what it would take. Even if you had that, you would have the fact that they're economic migrants, and economic migrants in general don't go through citizenship to the same extent as political refugees do. So there's a little bit of both things going on. I don't want to leave the impression that I think that this is all the Mexicans' fault. I don't think that's true at all. I think that the fact that these people are not legal means that even if they want to become citizens with all their heart and with all their mind, if they're not legal, they can't. And that's the basic truth of it.
We just have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Jacob Vigdor. He is Associate Professor of Public Policy Studies and Economics at Duke University and a Faculty Research Fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and is the author of a study, Measuring Immigrant Assimilation in the United States, just came out in May. And if you'd like to read it, take yourself to the website of the Manhattan Institute, and you can find it there. Questions are also welcome here as we continue. Again, about 10 minutes left in this part of the show. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have some other folks here to talk with. Effingham is the next caller. Our line number four, toll free line. Hello.
Yes. Migration is as old as humans, or as old as life itself. It occurs to me that the non-Spanish or German population in Mexico were here first. The third thing, the exacerbation of immigration and its effects on human culture is largely responsible for a worn-out paradigm such as capitalism, which is now 700 years old. It has scoured the earth. It now divines and separates people knowingly with money. The so-called early settlers, you know, from Western Europe, who brought the system with them, now discriminates wantonly. And the last thing is, how is the Earth under capitalism going to survive when there are even 8 billion people upon this Earth, which keeps increasing, population increases as opportunity declines? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I'll start out by saying that I'm an economist by training, and so what economists think is that markets often get things right, but they don't always get things right. And so I think that a lot of the problems that we are witnessing these days in environmental problems, in some of the degradation that you've talked about, results from capitalism requiring a few fetters on it, from requiring greater regulation. I'm not going to sit around and advocate that, say, we need sort of a more command economy, sort of like the old Soviet Union, and that would be good for us. If you look at the Soviet Union's environmental record, and you know, you look at China, of course, and China has an economy that's controlled largely by the state. Their environmental records are not really all that great. In fact, they're quite awful. So I don't necessarily look at capitalism as being a great evil that has caused all this destruction. I do think that you do need to have some degree of regulation on markets. And the extent to which immigration is a factor in this, I think, is kind of questionable. As I mentioned with the earlier caller, I think in a lot of cases, immigration takes people away from countries where there is great pressure to degrade the environment and brings them to more developed countries where there actually are greater protections in place. So in the long run, you can look at immigration as being something that could help forestall the greater destruction of environmental resources worldwide.
All right. Again, to another caller. This is Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. You know, when you use the term assimilation, and a lot of the callers have pointed this out, that along with that goes the process of discrimination on the part of the public. And yet, if we didn't discriminate on the basis of national origin, wouldn't we discriminate on something else again? As a sort of an intellectual exercise, I've been sitting here substituting country of origin, one's occupation. And wouldn't somebody say, people always say, what's your line of work? And the epithets are there even. The number of times I'm a retired college professor, and the number of times I've been called a fuzzy-headed intellectual are numerous, and that's from my own brother, you know. And I have a feeling that this whole process is quite natural to the human condition. And I see nothing wrong with it as long as people aren't physically harmed by it, or you know, they may be discriminated against, but and if it's kept at a minimum and doesn't do great harm, I see it as just a natural kind of thing. And I'll take your comment off there.
Okay. If discrimination against immigrants were a really, really bad problem in the United States, we probably would not see as many immigrants coming to the United States as we actually do. I mean, the number of immigrants who are admitted legally every year is somewhere on the order of a million. If life as an immigrant in the United States was really awful, these people would go somewhere else. Maybe they would stay in their countries of origin, but there are plenty of other prosperous economies out there that are where an immigrant could possibly go. I think if you look at the immigrant experience in the United States and compare it, say, to the immigrant experience in France or the immigrant experience in Germany, those are two developed countries that have really difficult problems with their immigrant populations because there are much more ingrained forms of discrimination against the foreign-born populations in those countries. When you put the United States in this kind of international perspective, I think it really doesn't look all that bad.
I wonder if over time, if you look at how it is we have thought about immigrants and group them according to their reasons for coming here, whether in fact we have tended to discriminate against people based on just on that, and whether in fact we always have tended to discriminate some against people who came here purely as economic immigrants. Do you think that's the case?
Economic immigrants have this difficulty in many cases that they are relatively – in many cases, if you look through history, there are plenty of examples, whether you're looking at the Irish in the 19th century, Italians in the early 20th century, or Mexicans and other Latin Americans in the early 21st century. They are relatively less educated. They are much less educated than the native-born population as a whole. And that sets them up for a special kind of vulnerability, I think, which in many cases a political refugee wouldn't have to face. And, you know, a political refugee is going to be able to particularly if they in many cases, if you look at the experience with Cuban immigrants in the United States or immigrants from the Philippines in the United States, those immigrants from those countries are very often politically motivated immigrants. They are often drawn from the economic elite of their origin countries. And they managed to fit in pretty well here. And their experience is much different than those who arrive with very little education, who really have to fight to get along in the labor market. So I imagine that the experience is very different for immigrants who come here for different reasons.
All right. Let's talk to another caller here. Also someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi, yes. Yeah. I just wanted to ask for some nuance, I think, to the argument that the guest is making, because to suggest that the people come from Mexico or from the rest of Latin America only for economic reasons or even primarily for economic reasons, I think elides the other reasons that people come for the opportunities that healthcare provide in the United States, the need for different kinds of surgery that you cannot get, or for healthcare for children, or the displacement from something like Hurricane Mitch, damaging, you know, infrastructure and lifeways in a place like Honduras or Guatemala. And, you know, the significant number of pressures that people are put under in the places in which they live or from which they come from that deprive them of a certain sense of being human, whether it is, you know, their ability to be a man or be a woman and provide in all ways for the family, not just simply in an economic means. And I think that the difference between why those people identify themselves coming to the United States and what they see the United States as opposed to what the United States really is for people coming from their particular social standing or cultural standing, is one that I haven't yet heard really represented in the comments that are being made by the guest. And I'm curious if the guest would like to respond to that. Thank you.
All right.
Well, from one perspective, there are 40 million immigrants in the United States, and if you talk to each one of those 40 million immigrants, you would probably get millions of different stories and millions of different motivations. And I am abstracting from that to some extent by sort of lumping this all together and saying, well, people are immigrating for economic reasons. But a lot of the stories that we just heard from the caller, being an economist by training, I do tend to boil things down that way. But if people are coming because they were displaced by Hurricane Mitch, well, that's a case of economic opportunities being lost in an origin country because of a natural disaster, much the way that economic opportunities have been lost in New Orleans because of Hurricane Katrina. If I think about an immigrant, say, from a developed country who comes to the United States because they want to have some surgical procedure or they're interested in sort of the protections that are available for people in American society, that looks like economic reasons to me as well. And my tendency – so if you want to fault me for seeing things in a predominantly economic light, I apologize for that. That's my professional training. That's kind of what I do. But I will acknowledge that beneath this sort of generalization, there is a lot of nuance there. There are a lot of different individual motivations for wanting to come to the United States. And in some cases, those individual differences – will have very important meanings for what happens in terms of assimilation. If you're coming to the United States in order to make some money so you can send money home and eventually go back to your origin country and become an entrepreneur, that's going to mean something very different from what we should expect from you in terms of assimilation than from an immigrant who comes because they're concerned that there are not opportunities there for their children, and they want their children to grow up American because they feel that there are better opportunities for them here. We'd expect very different things from people who fit those profiles. And there are many different profiles out there, and it would take me hours upon hours to really do justice to them all. And so I do engage in a little bit of shorthand here by referring to this as economically motivated migration.
Yeah. We're at the point where, my apologies to the caller, we're just at the point where we're going to have to stop. I guess for you, what is the bottom line here of the story that we've been talking about here over the last hour?
I think the bottom line is that the experience of immigrants over the past 25 years or so has been encouraging in some respects, but in other respects, it's also represents some challenges to American society. What's sort of happening this year, it seems, is that the questions of immigration policy have kind of fallen off the political radar for a period of time. And that may be because any presidential candidate who starts talking about immigration is immediately going to make a whole bunch of people mad, no matter what they say. But I think that what this report about assimilation really points out is that we have to come back to this issue. We're going to have to do something about the policies that we have in place, because the policies that we have in place are responsible for some of the things that look like failures of immigrants to experience success in the United States. And I think in the long run, we don't want to be a country that is marked by an immigrant population that is at a substantial disadvantage and at a persistent disadvantage compared to the rest of us.
There, we'll have to leave it. Jacob Vigdor, our guest, he's Associate Professor of Public Policy Studies and Economics at Duke University. If you'd like to read the report that he authored looking at immigrant assimilation in the United States, you can do that by going to the website of the Manhattan Institute. Professor Vigdor, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me again, David.